freedom970.com or Freedom 970 online. The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified. We got a great show this morning, and hopefully you're out there with your phone ready to call and ask Harry Dand, economist and author, a question. And this is your opportunity to call in for free. The numbers are 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Or toll free if you're in the outlying areas, 1-800-990-0750, 1-800-990-0750. And there are many people listening to us on the web as well. I know that for a fact because I've had people email me and tell me they've been listening to our show on the web, which is kind of cool. And I do want to mention that we got this morning, we're going to have Harry Dent on the line. And Harry Dent Jr. is an author, senior editor, along with his co-editor, Rodney Johnson, of the free newsletter, Survive and Prosper. And listen, if you don't have a copy of that and you're not getting a copy of that, you're really missing a lot of information. And it's free. Free's a good price. You can get that at pfgwm.com, or you can go directly to Harry's site at harrydent.com, and you can get that. You can also get a copy of The Demographic Cliff, Harry's new book, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 and 19. And by gosh, believe it or not, we are in 2014. So in studio this morning with me is co-host Kevin Stege of the Baker Coastal CPA firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Kevin. And I think we're going to have a great show this morning.
I think so.
And listen, if you've got a question, there is no foolish question when it comes to your money. If you got a question about the economy and you want to call in and you want to ask Harry Dent a question, we will put you on the air. We will also, if you want to ask a question and you want a free copy of his book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014, if you call and ask a question, you can come by my office, pick up a copy for free.
And free's a good price.
And free's a good price.
That's right.
As I always say, the price is right.
That's right.
You know, when it's free. Well, we're gonna be joined here soon. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties here in the studio, but we're gonna have Harry Dent online very soon. And Kevin, I know you and I both subscribe to his Survive and Prosper. So with that, I've already given my introduction. And is he there? Okay. And we're going to have Harry Dent come on here real quick. Harry, are you there?
Yes.
Oops, got a little disconnection there. You there,
Harry? Can you
Harry?
Hear me?
Yep, I can,
okay.
Yes.
Good.
Yep. Well, Harry, we're excited about having you on the air because of all the activity going on in the marketplace and things that have been going on in the economy. And, you know, as I look at this economy, you've been saying for some time, and I happen to watch I watch Fox Business News in the morning when I'm working out, and I happen to see Bill Rogers on there this week. And of course, the news guys are all wanting everybody to pump money into the market to keep the market going up and up and up. And his comment was, the basic fundamentals of investing is buy low and sell high. The market's at a high. I'm selling. I'm getting out of all my equities.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, I keep telling people, and people think I'm crazy, Chuck. You know, this is a bubble. I lay the Dow from late 94 into early 2000 over the Dow from early 2009 into now, and it's an exact correlation. I mean, you know, and in any way you want to measure it, And people keep saying this is not a bubble because this and that, and the government's not going to let the stocks go down. The fact that the government has created this artificial rebound through, you know, endless deficits and quantitative easing is a bigger reason to be scared. I mean, I keep telling people the pattern of the market is very clear. We've seen bubble after bubble. You saw a stock bubble in early 2000 peak, the tech bubble, and then the tech wreck and crash. And then we went to a slight new high in 2007, and then we went to new lows in early 2009. Now we've gone to slight new highs again, and we're due in the next few years to go to new lows, you know, like 6,000 or lower. And that, I mean, this is a very obvious pattern, especially given that the baby boomers have peaked in their spending back in 2007, as we predicted 20 years ago. This is a very simple thing to predict when the average family will spend the most money. And we were due to see economic momentum peak in late 2007, and we did, and it went down. And all the debt started to come due, but governments stepped in around the world, central banks, and said, we will not have a downturn. And I'm like, that's stupid. The economy knows how to balance itself, just like our own body does when we get, you know, sick or eat bad sushi or something. And the economy was trying to flush out this debt, rebalance, flush out these financial bubbles and debt bubbles, and governments just said, oh, no, we can't let it happen. I'm like, this is bad policy, and it's going to end badly. And I think right now we're towards the end of this five-year artificial bubble. I mean, the bubbles before were fundamental. We had good demographic trends in spending. We had technologies, internet moving mainstream on an S curve, just like, you know, automobiles from 1914 to 1928. You know, with that bubble, those were fundamentals, and then investors overdo it, and we always get bubbles. But this is an artificial bubble, which is really dangerous, and the biggest artificial bubble in the world is China today. China has overbuilt everything by 30 to 40%, infrastructures, housing, industrial capacity, government push people from rural areas to urban areas at faster rates than anybody can absorb. China's going to see the biggest disaster in history. Economists are saying this is the new economic model. I'm saying this is going to fail. This is going to burst worse than anything. So I tell investors, like you say, hey, we've had bubbles. Take your gains, protect your assets, and wait for the next crash, because I think it's just around the corner.
Yeah, I've been talking to people that, and I've been showing them your megaphone effect, and running the cycles of the market, and it's clear as day if you look at what's happened and where we're heading, and we're going to have a major correction in the market. I don't think there's any question about it. And in fact, the amazing thing to me, Harry, you've been saying this for some time, but finally now some of the so-called gurus of Wall Street are finally starting to kind of listen, and they're kind of starting to come out and say, you know what? Maybe there's something to this.
Yeah, you know, David Tepper just came out and said, hey, you should be nervous. Ralph Acampora, who's a great long-term technical analyst, I've got a major cycle that I stole from him after it proved right. And he's saying, you know, all these people saying, oh, we're going to have a correction. I am crystal clear on this, Chuck. When you have bubbles, they don't correct. They burst. They go to extremes, I have to say, just like an orgasm, and then bam, they go down. And that's what's happened. And you know, when I go on CNBC and say, hey, the Dow could go to 17,000, give or take, and then down to 5,000 to 6,000, people say, you're crazy. I'm like, I'm not crazy. This is what we've seen for the last 15 years. Bubble burst, but there is a point where all the stimulus fails and you can't keep the bubble going forever. And that's what governments are trying to do. They've created bubbles through ultra-low interest rates and stimulus and encouraged all this overinvestment and speculation in real estate and stocks and commodities and everything else. And now they're saying, oh, well, our only policy is to keep the bubble going forever. You can't keep a bubble going forever. Nobody can do that. So I think it's about to burst. And when it does, it's going to be worse than last time. That's what I tell people. And I tell people also, look, if I'm wrong about this, we're going to know probably by the end of this year. I mean, we're probably going to see a more substantial correction in stocks, 20 to 30% by late summer or fall. And if we don't see that, then yeah, maybe governments have kind of, you know, kept this going another year or so. But I think the odds of that are very low. Be safe now. Sell on rallies in stocks and things. And again, just wait. If we see some problems later this year, then it's going to take a couple years for this to wash out, just like 2000, 2002, or 1930-32. It's going to take two and a half years to wash out. And then you're going to be able to buy stocks and real estate and stuff down the road at bargain prices and invest again in a market that could grow long-term. But right now, at Dow 17,000, even, you know, clear models show that if you buy stocks here near 17,000 on the Dow, the odds are you're going to make minus 1 to 3% over the next decade because they're so overvalued. So this is a bad investing environment.
Yeah, you're absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And I'll tell you, the people who are putting their head in the sand and are just going full bore into the market are just going to get killed. They're going to get totally devastated in their portfolios. And if they think they can buy and hold and then ride it out, people who tried to buy and hold in 07, who didn't really use the strategies we talked to them about, it took them 5.5 years. And some of those funds, the people who invest in mutual funds, some of those funds have yet to recover.
And, you know, and this is what happens throughout history. We show that demographic trends, new generations, earning and spending more money as they raise their families. This is a predictable thing. I mean, we predicted 20 years ago that the economic momentum in the United States would peak around late 2007 and turn down for a decade and a half. We predicted in the late 80s that Japan would crash while the rest of the world boomed, just simply on demographics. So there are periods where the fundamental trends turn down, like 1929 to 42, 1968 to 82, and now late 2007 to 2020 to 23, where the trends get more volatile in stocks, they go more down, and buy and hold does not work. Most of the time it does work, and asset allocation works most of the times, but not in these periods where trends turn adverse. And again, this is not something that's just about government policies or this or that. This is something anybody can see decades in advance. And again, we've been predicting this downturn since the late 80s when I developed my demographic tools, and I've developed other cycles since, like the commodity cycle and the geopolitical cycle. All of my core cycles, four major cycles developed over 30 years, now point down at the same time between mid-2014 and late 2019. The next 5 to 6 years, I think, are going to be the worst we see in our lifetime in investment. And again, the secret is just get out of the way. Be safe. And look to reinvest when this kind of basically artificial stimulus fails. Anybody that thinks that governments can solve global financial problems and crises by just simply printing money and throwing it in the economy, like taking more and more of a drug, keep coming down from a high, anybody that thinks that's going to work doesn't know their ass from a hole in the wall. And that's what I said about most economists. They don't understand our economy. They don't understand the dynamics of the free market capitalist system that needs inflation and deflation to promote innovation, boom and bust. The greatest innovation comes in the bust, not in the booms. So they're tinkering with the most successful system in history, back to the late 1700s with the American Revolution and the Industrial Revolution and steam engine. And they're thinking they can make it better by manipulating the economy. This is the biggest mistake I've seen in history, so it's not going to work out well. You can't do anything about that as an individual investor or business, but you can get out of the way and let it happen.
Well, it sounds to me then maybe the best thing to do, and I'm alluding to your article in Survive and Prosper last from Wednesday a week ago, maybe the thing to do is to get into real estate then, since real estate always appreciates. And I have a feeling you have an opinion on that or a perspective on that too.
Well, you know, again, people think the real estate downturn is over. It's only begun. Real estate was one of the big bubbles, and it happened in Japan a decade and a half before it happened, hit the U.S., and it's going to hit Europe and other countries next. Real estate got leveraged up by unprecedented borrowing. Everyday people could borrow money against their home and then borrow money against their home equity line and put their kids in private schools or invest in condos and vacation homes and stuff. This is the greatest real estate bubble in history, and it's greatest in China. These real estate bubbles are going to continue to burst as debt deleverages and the economy slows down. So people think, yeah, real estate, it's a real asset, and you know, they're not making any more of it. Yes, maybe long term, but real estate is going to go down further. I have been renting my home in Florida, in Tampa, since I moved from Miami to Tampa in late 2005. That's when I said in my newsletter that the real estate bubble was peaking, and it looked to burst. Robert Shiller was the only other economist that said that at the time. And my home, the home I'm living in, is worth half what it was if I had bought it in late 2005. So my wife didn't like that decision at the time, but I said, look, just listen to me. Real estate's going down. Let's rent. And we've been very happy we've done. So I don't think the real estate bust is over yet. I think we've bounced here. It's a very tepid bounce. If I was just looking at the real estate price chart, like any chart I would look at stocks or anything, I'd say this is a dead cat bounce. And I have a new indicator, which is in the demographic cliff in Chapter 3, one of the biggest indicator I've come up with in the last several years, that you know, real estate goes in cycles. People buy real estate between age 27 and 41. So we can project those trends. But what I had to do with real estate, unlike other consumer sectors, is adjust for the fact that real estate lasts forever and older people are going to die and be sellers. Baby boomers, there's more baby boomers than echo boomers. And as we go forward, there's going to be more people dying, which I call sellers, than younger people buying. And the net demand for real estate is in Japan for the last 2 years, is going to be more down than up for decades to come. So real estate's not going to be the same. At some point, it'll go lower and be a good buying opportunity, but it's not going to come roaring back like it did in past cycles when you have a larger generation being followed by a smaller generation. So there's some very things people need to understand about the future. Stocks will go up again when the economy rebounds the next generation, but real estate is not going to be as good an investment from my point of view, and I do see it going lower, especially in the next several years.
You know, one of the concerns I have about that, Harry, we have somewhat of a booming building bust out here in America, in the Northwest right now. We're building like crazy. We're building homes. We're building commercial properties, and I see all these properties come up, but the ones that we have existing are half full. And I'm wondering if this is going to just be a compounding effect. If real estate, residential real estate, what's going to happen to commercial real estate? Because they're building it like there's no tomorrow. And where are the companies being created to go in and go in those spots?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, developers are going to continue to overbuild real estate. I mean, we're not going to need most of the real estate people think we need. But there are exceptions. Real estate is very local and regional. And you have areas like Oregon and Washington and British Columbia that are growing because people are immigrating there. People are moving from California to Oregon. People are moving from China to Vancouver and places like that. So there, real estate has its own local supply and demand. I mean, I always give people in my presentations the examples of two places I've lived in, Dallas and Miami. And both have grown substantially in the last few decades, but Dallas didn't bubble up because they got endless flat land. The joke there is you can watch your dog run away all day. You know, in Miami, it's the opposite. You got ocean and the Everglades behind it. So it's very limited. Everybody's moving there. So it bubbles up, but bubbles crash. And people don't understand that. So, yeah, I would agree that the Northwest and British Columbia are some of the stronger areas because of migration and immigration. But whatever bubbles up goes down in the end. So I would, yeah, I think I would be most cautious in areas like that. I even my own personal assistant lives in Dallas still after we moved to Tampa, our business, and she wanted to buy a house, got a good deal in Dallas. And I said, you know, you're okay. Your downside may be 10%, 20%, but man, in Portland or Seattle, especially in Vancouver, one of the biggest bubbles in real estate, I think the downside is higher precisely because it's gone up. San Francisco is bubbling again. L.A., Orange County, and a lot of Chinese buyers. This is not a good sign. People should recall that when Japan had their great real estate and stock bubble in the late 80s, they were buying real estate around the world, bidding it up. And then when their bubble burst, they stopped buying and it collapsed. And the Chinese are even bigger now. And so when the Chinese bubble burst, and it is the biggest bubble in the world, I tell people over and over for the last 2 to 3 years, if the China bubble doesn't burst, I will quit my profession, you know, in 5 or 6 years if it doesn't burst, and I will become a limo driver in Australia, because this is the greatest bubble I've ever seen, and it's government-driven, which makes it worse.
Well, you know, I ran a few numbers last night, and in Oregon, the median value of an owner-occupied home is about $246,000 right now, and the median household income is $50,000. And if you just run common sense numbers, that's roughly debt to income ratio of about 45%. And that is that, you know, that's where we were 5 years ago, and it's back there again.
Yes.
So
yes. Back there again. That's the point. We've bubbled up again. It's worse in California. It's way worse in Vancouver and places like that, in Australia, which I was just lecturing at for a month in February. So the good news, it's not as extreme in Portland and Oregon as it is in California or Vancouver, but you're right. Everything has bubbled back up to different degrees, and so people should be cautious. People just don't understand bubbles. There's something about human nature, you know, because bubbles are like a high. You know, you have to work hard for most things, but when bubbles happen in real estate or stocks or commodities or gold or anything else, people hold, you basically get something for nothing for a period, for 4, 5, 6 years. And people don't want the high to end, so they just go into denial, and people never see bubbles. This is the greatest bubble in modern history. It's the most global. As I said earlier, China is the most extreme, and people think, oh, China's bubble can't burst. China's bubble will burst. It's a 99% certainty. It's just a question of when, and the cracks are starting to show with developers failing and developers discounting condos for the first time and corporate defaults and you know, things like that. China's bubble is starting to burst. And everybody thinks, well, the government can let it down slowly. I tell people, show me one time in history where we've had a bubble and governments or financial institutions were able to let it down slowly. It doesn't happen. Bubbles don't correct. They burst.
Harry, the amazing thing to me is just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, all over the news was that China is surpassing us as the world's number one economy.
You know, Chuck, 1989, when I predicted in my first book that Japan was going to collapse in the 1990s, while the U.S. and Europe and most Western countries had the greatest boom in history, greater than the Roaring Twenties, people thought I was nuts. Same thing back then. Economists were just projecting in a straight line in the future the growth of Japan, which was stellar. That Japan went from an emerging country to a developed country in just over 3 decades, and then followed by South Korea. This does not happen very often. So people were saying, oh, Japan's growing, and they're going to, and they said back then Japan was going to surpass the U.S. They became the second largest economy in the world, and they said they're going to surpass the United States by 2010. I said, this is nuts. They would have to have 3 times our per capita GDP to surpass us, because they're a third of our population, and they're at their peak of demographics, and they're getting ready to fall with the greatest real estate and stock bubble in history. This is the same with China. China has overbuilt everything by 30 to 40%. I mean, more than any country, any time in history, this bubble is going to collapse. It's going to take China 10 years to get over this overcapacity. And by the time they come out of that big downturn, they're going to see their demographics turn down almost as much as Japan, the first emerging country. China is not going to be the growth engine of the future. They can grow to some degree with urbanization, since they're only 53% urban and they're moving towards 70-80% over time like any emerging country, but their demographics are turning down already, and they're going to turn down more in the next decade. China is going to be the big surprise of the next decade, and the second biggest surprise, Chuck, is going to be Germany. Germany's demographic chart of spending with an aging population is going to turn down faster than any country in the developed world in the next 8 years, faster than Japan did in the 90s, and everybody thinks Germany's going to hold up the euro. I'm like, good luck on that. Ain't going to happen.
You know, I built my practice in the early 90s off your book, The Great Boom Ahead. In fact, I did seminars almost every other week on The Great Boom Ahead, and we used to, I don't know how many of those books I bought, but I bought a lot of them. And we gave them out at the seminar trying to tell people about that. And then when you came out with your book, The Great Depression Ahead, I ran seminars on that as well. And I've been telling people, look, Harry Dent's demographics is not voodoo. It is a scientific fact. It's a mathematical fact. Demographics are for real. And I just cringe when I hear guys like Ron and Santa and guys on the news that say, well, I don't believe in it. It's not a religion. It's a mathematical scientific fact of what's going to happen and take place.
Yeah, I agree, Chuck. You know, I debate Ron, and I call him Ron and Sana. But, you know, I debate him on CNBC, and he says stuff. He said one time in one debate, and I took his head off, when he said, baby boomers will only spend more money as they age. And I'm like, Ron, I'm looking at the facts, which we update every year over the last 20, 30 years, when people spend money, and people spend less money after age 46 and dramatically more after age 53. It is, like you said, it's a fact. We can predict when people are going to spend and not. And people just come up with these delusions to keep the bubble and bull market going. It's just like, you're right. This is a fact. Now, what I do caution people about who follow me, we have been very accurate about long-term trends. Again, 20-some years ago, we said that the U.S. economy is going to peak around late 2007 or so and then turn down for over a decade. And then Japan was going to peak, you know, in late 89 or 90 and turn down for over a decade. I mean, you know, we predicted these things, but in the short term, it's a whole different thing. In the short term, you can have all types of geopolitical events like Ukraine and Russia today, or the Iraq War, or tsunami in Japan. These are things I can't predict, but we do have a geopolitical cycle that tells you when you're more likely to have those events, and that is between 2001, 9/11, and 2019. And so the geopolitical environment continues to get worse. We've had one thing after the next since 9/11, and there's going to be more to come. And Israel is one of the countries that have the strongest technological innovation and the strongest demographic trends of a developed country in the future. But I tell people, I'm not going to invest in Israel until we're over this adverse geopolitical cycle, say by early 2020 or so, because they're in the worst part of the world where the worst geopolitical things are happening and continue to happen. So we have demographics is our core research, but we have, again, commodity cycles, geopolitical cycles, and a decennial boom-bust cycle that gives us more refinement. But the short term is much harder to predict. I know this bubble's going to burst. I just don't know exactly when. My cycles are telling me we're very close, that between April and June, we're probably putting in a peak here, and then we see a two-and-a-half-year crash that will be stronger than 2008 to 2009 and more like the crash in 2000-2002. And so it's just time. You know, the more markets go up, investors should get more safe and sell out. And then if they crash, then you can get back in. Even in longer-term bear markets, there are strong bull market rallies like 1932 to 37. The stocks went up 300 to 400%. in still a depressionary economy, and they crashed again. But I think that there's going to be another rally at some point. But right now, stocks are way overvalued, and people say they're not overvalued. They are. They don't know their ass from a hole in the wall. They're in the bubble mentality, and everybody from Ron and Sana is arguing, oh, this is not a bubble because this and that. When everybody's saying it's not a bubble, it's a bubble. If it looks like a bubble, walks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble, it is a bubble, and this is the final bubble. Not just a bubble, but the final bubble of many that has been created artificially by stimulus. And when it crashes, we're not going to go back to new highs for a long time, just like 1929 to 42 and 68 to 82. So investors need to take their gains. Thank God for them. We got these bubbles in real estate and stocks and commodities. Take your gains and protect what you have.
Yep, absolutely. One of the other concerns I have about the economy that we're kind of that everybody's kind of forgetting about, but it wasn't that long ago when we heard that California was bankrupt, that Michigan was bankrupt, that New York was in deep trouble.
Illinois and Chicago.
Yeah, well, what's going on with all that? You don't hear anything about it on the news at all anymore.
Well, you know, this stuff comes up and then people wash it away, you know. And everybody is bankrupt. Our country, we're not bankrupt long term. I compare this in business to what I call a Chapter 11 restructuring of debt. We're still the largest economy in the world, and China is not going to surpass us, especially in U.S. dollars. You know, you adjust for purchasing power, they look better than they seem. But they're about half the size of our economy, and Japan is a third. We're the largest country in the world. We still lead in innovation, although some other countries are coming up, India, China, here and there. But we are way too much in debt. Everybody's, China has unimaginable debts that most people aren't measuring. Europe, I mean, I look around the world, the greatest debt bubble in history, when you get to those extremes, you have to rebalance this debt. We're going to have to write off debts. We're going to have to retire at age 75 instead of 65 because our life expectancy has gone up more than 10 years since Social Security and health care and Medicaid was, you know, created and stuff. We're not in reality. We need to get back in reality. It's going to be painful at first, but it's going to be good for the long term if we have what I call the Great Reset. We had a great reset in the 1930s, the Great Depression. We had a great reset before that in the 1830s and 40s. These resets come once in a lifetime, but the problem is nobody sees them coming because the more things bubble up, the longer stocks go up, the longer real estate goes up, the more people believe, oh, they can't go down. That's the wrong point of view. The greater that you see markets go up and the more they get overvalued, the more downside there is. That's what the greatest investors and value investors realize throughout history, and people are just blind to this incredible bubble. It will burst. And again, I tell people in my presentations recently, if we don't see, when all my cycles turn down in the next 6 years, if we do not see a major bubble burst around the world, including China, in the next 6 years, I will quit my profession and become a limo driver in Australia. I literally will do that. There's almost no way I can see this won't happen. So
why Australia?
Australia? Yeah. One of the few countries in the world, developed, wealthy countries, that has a larger echo boom than the baby boom. U.S., our echo boom is slightly smaller. In Japan, it's non-existent. Germany, non-existent. Most of Europe, non-existent. So everybody else is going to be fighting falling demographic trends. Australia will not. Australia has the lowest debt ratios, especially government debt at 20% of GDP, of any wealthy country. It is kind of off in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's going to invade or have a war with Australia. They are a very civil society, very law-abiding, even though they drink like crazy, and the bar is open at 10 in the morning. But if I tell people, in the developed world, once we have this crash, what country would I invest in? Australia would be on the top of my list in the developed world. And when I look at the emerging world, especially the countries that have strong demographics, which most of them do, and less exposure to the falling commodity cycle, India would be my number one. And they just finally elected a pro-business, prime minister.
That's right. I heard that on the news.
The first time. Modi. I mean, this guy, this is what India needs. I've been to India three times in the last 8 years. Very creative people, huge country, huge potential growth. They just don't have infrastructures. The government has been too socialist and too bureaucratic. This is a huge shift for India. I wouldn't invest in India now because the market's at a new high. But once we see a global crash, India be number one in the emerging world, Australia be my number one investment in the developed world. And if I had to sit through this crisis, and if I could afford to move to Australia, which I can't, I'm much more popular, by the way, in Australia than I am here in the U.S. I lecture there every couple years, and I just do very, very well. I would move to Australia. I think they will have a downturn because they're exposed to the commodity cycle falling, and their real estate bubble is one of the highest in the world. But their demographics are good. Their debt is low, outside of consumer debt around. So I think Australia will weather this better than any major developed country in the world.
One other major concern that came up this week, and I do a lot of 401k planning with companies, smaller companies, where we help them with their 401k and invest the money. But one of the concerns that came out here just this last week was that they've ran a survey and that the Gen Xers are actually contributing a lot less percentage-wise to their 401ks than the baby boomers did. And that the younger people just don't have the faith in the government and the stock market that it's going to prevail and give them a return on their money. And that's a concern because there are less of them, and we still need to have them putting their money into the marketplace to get that money back into the structure of the country.
Well, you know, first of all, younger people don't invest as much. People spend from age 20 when they enter the workforce on average into age 46, and more affluent people continue to spend into age 53 before they fall off. It's after that peak in spending that people invest the most. But also, I mean, the Gen Xers and the echo boom, the millennials to follow, they're facing the worst economy since the 1930s. The youth unemployment and young people's unemployment is extremely high, way higher than the normal statistics. They're seeing housing fall for the first time in their lifetime, and they don't even feel like they can buy a house and feel good about it, and they can't get credit as easy. So these people are more cautious, and they don't have as good of jobs as the baby boomers had in the 50s and 60s and stuff and 70s when they continued to enter the workforce and grew up. So they have a different mentality, and it's more like the Bob Hope generation, who came of age in the Great Depression and World War II. This generation is seeing the next Great Depression, which is still yet to come because governments have tried to stall it and prevent it. And they've seen terrorism and things on a level. So they're going to have a whole different psychology. The baby boomers grew up in La La Land and always were too optimistic. And the baby boomers did not save enough money, and they do not have high savings for retirement. And that's going to be affected by lower returns now, zero returns in bonds adjusted for inflation. Stocks have been going sideways since 2000 peak and the tech wreck. These people, baby boomers, are going to have to stay in the workforce longer just to survive, and that's going to further hurt these younger people who are also saddled with unprecedented real estate prices, debt ratios, and entitlements for the baby boomers that will never, ever, ever be able to be paid. We're going to have a big reset on entitlements. Like I said earlier, we're going to have to retire at 75 instead of 65. And that's going to be forced only by a crisis, because it's not a good political platform, as Paul Ryan knows, to come out and say, oh, we got to restructure entitlements. He wasn't even in the ballpark of what it would take to restructure entitlements with reality. And he was, like, scoffed for saying, oh, we can't afford all this stuff.
Yeah, his approach was putting a Band-Aid on an arm that's coming off.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, the other concern I have, Harry, is that the government's still printing money. We now have a 10-year note. I noticed on Friday it closed at 2.518.
Yeah, and we have a 2% inflation rate on average in the last few years.
It's insane.
So it is insane. Governments have pushed this down. I think rates are probably going up in the next year as the government. We are tapering, which takes some pressure off of buying. So that means yields will tend to trend up. And my research shows that inflation, although that is not my big concern from money printing, like all the gold bugs, inflation is a lagging indicator. And I think inflation is going to edge up over the next year as the economy slows. The worst of all worlds for the Fed. It's going to be hard for them to up their stimulus again if the economy slows. If inflation is rising, and it's gone from 1% low recently back up to 2%, and it's probably going to go to 3% or so in the next time. So I think bond yields are going to go up. That's going to hurt mortgage rates and the housing recovery that is already faltering, as we predicted a year or two ago, that this was largely speculative buying by hedge funds and individual investors. It's not everyday echo boomers buying homes with mortgages. That's been flat after dying for the last 3 or 4 years. It has not recovered. So real estate is the weak point of the U.S. economy. The China bubble is set to burst and showing signs of bursting. And again, Germany and big parts of Europe are going to go off a bigger demographic cliff in the next several years that nobody's expecting. Just, again, I was the only one in 1989 that said Japan is going to burst, not only because they had huge bubbles in real estate and stocks, but because their demographics were going to collapse and work against them. That's what I see for Europe now, even worse than the United States. Our demographics are going to get worse in the next several years, but Europe is going to go off its first cliff. Europe has yet to go off their demographic cliff, as I say in this new book. And when Europe, already in trouble now due to low productivity, low innovation, and the imbalances that the euro created artificially, what happens when their demographics turn against them? And my answer is it's not going to be pretty.
Well, listen, Harry, we appreciate your time, and thank you very much today for being on our show. We have been talking constantly on our show every week about your book and also about your free newsletter, Survive and Prosper. People can go either on your site or our site and sign up for it. And I know I have a lot of clients who have signed up for it and are now getting that. And I also have talked to a lot of them about signing up for Boom and Bust, because there is some dynamite information in that presentation that you and Rodney do. So that is a great source for our clients to listen to. But we appreciate your time. We'll talk to you in a couple of months, and we'll be talking to Rodney next month.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Harry. Thank you very much. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Investing Simplified. And if you want to call and ask a question, you can give us a call at 503, if I can find that number here.
417-7626 or 800-990-0750.
Thank you for bailing me out, Kevin. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified. Don't forget, if you give a call and ask a question, we'll give you a free book, Harry Dent's new book. So give us a call.
We do Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. 417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified on a overcast Saturday morning, Portland, Oregon. We just had a scintillating session with Harry Dent, and it's always good to get his perspective, and I think there's always something to learn and put into the mix of information and hopefully make some wise investing decisions in the future.
Knowledge is power.
That's right. Well, you know, Chuck, you sent me an email regarding a couple questions on the sale of a principal residence, or I should say the sale of real estate, and how to get the principal residence exclusion. And I didn't print the email. I was environmentally conscious there. And oh, but maybe you have it. But I didn't bring my phone either. So my wife, if you're listening, yes, I will be home after the show. Two very good questions, both regarding real estate that has been used as something other than a principal residence and then sold later, or maybe a planned sale, and how can you get that principal residence exclusion? There we go. That's got it. Okay, how can you get that principal residence exclusion and save the most tax on that piece of real estate?
Yeah, I think actually the first part of the question was a client has a rental property that they've had as a rental property for years and years. They have a couple of pieces of rental property, and the strategy they want to do is to sell their residence right now, take their tax break, move into one of the rental properties for 2 years, and then do the same thing.
That's right. And just the basic rules, back in 2000, I believe it was Bush put in the once in the lifetime exclusion is gone. We actually still get questions about that, and that's been gone for about 15 years now. And the new rules say if you live in a home for 2 years and you've owned it for two out of the last 5 years, you live in it two out of five and you owned it two out of five, then you can sell it, and a single person can exclude $250,000 of gain, and a married couple $500,000 of gain. A very nice tax break that Congress has afforded homeowners. And what we'll just talk about the $500,000. We'll just consider it a married couple, so we're not always bantering numbers here. But there was some misuse in those rules where people who had significant real estate holdings were just house hopping every 2 years into a rental or an investment property, selling it and excluding all of this gain.
Yeah, because they've wrote the rental property off. They depreciated the heck out of it. They got their cost basis down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so good time to move into it.
Exactly. And so that wasn't the intent of the principal resident exclusion. So they put, in 2009, they put some brakes on it. And so the key thing to note is, well, there's four factors that you really need to consider. And this is actually a fairly complicated area when it hasn't been your principal residence from an inception. And so really talk with your CPA, your tax guy or gal, and give them your exact circumstances, and they should be able to work you through the matrix. But it matters if this home was a rental property and had been depreciated in the past. It matters if it's just a second home or a vacation property or considered investment property, and it matters if you're a real estate professional or if you're in the business of selling real estate. Those all are very key factors in this whole thing. But in your situation here, the if it has not been used as a principal residence from inception, you have to look beginning at January 1st, 2009. That's the magic date that they picked when they put the brakes on the misuse. You have to look at any use after that that is non-qualified. And non-qualified use is simply not using it as your principal residence. And so an example is you've owned a home for, it's been a rental for a number of years. You reach 2009, you start counting the years after 2009 that it's been a rental, and then you move into it, say in 2014. And so 5 years, for 5 years, you had it as a rental and you lived in it 2 years, and now you sell it in 2016. Well, five sevenths of the time from 2009 was non-qualified use, so 5/7 of your gain is going to be taxable. So that's how the rules work.
So if you using that, let's say you moved into I had a rental in 09, it's been rented. Now I decide to move into it, so it's been 5 years. So if I live into it for 5 years, now I've got 50% of it would be consumed.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And the one thing I'm not mentioning in all of this is depreciation recapture. If you have depreciated a home, which is going to be a rental use, you always have to recapture that at a specified rate. They've got a special rate for that. And that always comes into income, even if you can't go back anymore, but you always have to recapture the depreciation to the extent of gain. So it's fairly complicated. Another example that you gave in the email was, what if you had some bare lots that just sat there for a number of years, and you decide to build a home on it, live in it 2 years, and sell it? The exact same rules apply. From 2009, if they sat there as bare lots, you got to count the number of years that you didn't use it as your principal residence, and that's non-qualified use. And so you've got your percentage, and you just you move on with it. So you know, it's still a good thing. You know, if you move into it and live in it for 5 years, and you know it's a nice location and it's what you like, you know, you can get half your gain excluded. So not a bad thing to consider.
Plus the fact is, I mean, if you can create a capital gain effect versus ordinary income effect, that is a big break today.
Absolutely, it is, and that's where, when I mentioned, if you're a real estate professional or if you're in the business of selling properties, you know, even if you're not, you know, officially licensed, this and that, if you have another home and you have a history of buying and selling properties or what they call flipping them, there's consideration that you're in the business, and not only do you not get capital gain rate on these, you're also subject to self-employment tax. I mean, you're in the business. This is like a wage to
you.
Well,
that's the problem with that riverfront property,
mm-hmm.
because that was done originally as a development.
I see.
And so this particular investor had invested that money into that property as a development. So basically, they're going to be getting ordinary income on that whenever they sell it. It's not going to ever be capital gain.
Potentially. I mean, you really want to look at the facts and circumstances and kind of look at the history and where they're at. If it's, you can buy and hold investment property and just hold it and then sell it, and you do get capital gains. But if the facts indicate that you're in the business of, and this is what you do, then another set of rules apply.
Yeah, and that is what they do.
Okay.
So, I mean, they're in the business development.
Yeah.
And they bought the property for that aspect. So mm-hmm. I think that would carry through probably.
Yeah. And so in that case, you know, you'd probably, you know, it's just considered inventory. I mean, it's just like if you buy and sell, you know, widgets, it's property is an inventory.
But, you know, if listening to Harry Dent, if Harry Dent's correct, it might not be a bad time to go ahead and take those. So go ahead and sell it and get the capital gains. At least you're making the money off of it instead of having a potential 10 or 20% decline. I would much rather take the money now, have the profits. Granted, you may have to pay, you know, 10% or 15% plus state, mm-hmm. but boy, it's still a lot less than paying ordinary income on it.
Well, and there's the 0% long-term capital gain bracket. Married couple, if your taxable income's at around $75,000, any portion of that below $75,000 that is attributed to capital gain, that's going to get a 0% rate, and that's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and then but probably, does they take the capital gains and add that to your ordinary income?
They do. So, yes, yeah. you have to, your total yeah. taxable income. So.
Yeah, because if you're making 70
at a,
and you have 60,000 tax, you know, capital gain, now you're at 130.
That's right. Only 5,000 of it would get
right.
0%.
Yeah,
and,
correct.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people get confused on that. It does count as far as your total income, although that part of the income is only taxed at capital gain rate.
Yes. It's an equation only an accountant could love or
Yeah, the IRS.
Exactly. So that's what we've got on the Tax Investigator today. If you
okay,
if you got
now it's almost too late to call. It's 8:54, so we're on the downside. Harry was pretty energetic today, wasn't he?
He was. That's I go through fits and spurts of reading his Survive and Prosper, and it's good to always get different perspectives and keep. Listening to what other people say, listen to the other side too. If Harry's, your theories and beliefs, you should be able to hold with an open hand and subject it to other ideas and theories. If it stands up, then you've got something good. And if not, it's no good. But, I think there's some truth in what he's saying.
Well, I've been following him since the late 80s and been using his books and stuff in my seminars and really built my practice in the 90s by doing seminars on the great boom ahead, and we had a lot of clients make a lot of money during that time using his theories and what was going to happen. But we also had to temper that down when we gave the projections of what he was saying was going to happen in 07 to 09. He actually had predicted 09 and it happened in 07, but he was pretty darn close when he predicted it way into the past, and to be able to do that 15, 20 years ahead of time is pretty amazing,
pretty significant.
But it was all based on demographics, and it's based on the fact that we're all getting older, and this country as a country is getting older, and the next generations coming up are just not the numbers. And it's not that the numbers aren't there as far as the population growth, because we're having population growth, and a lot of that is because of the immigrants. But the reality is that younger group coming up are not getting the higher paying jobs, and they're not and there's not as many numbers in them per year. Mm-hmm. That's the real key, and that's the volume of getting this thing going. So people need to be aware of that. And I do want to say, if you want to subscribe to his Survive and Prosper, you can go on my website at pfgwm.com. There's a link there, and you can sign up for his free newsletter. Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you?
We're at bakercolson.com. Our phone number is 503-666-5569. And we're located at 2414 Northeast Division out in Gresham.
Well, we're located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103. In the Price Finance Group building and in the Mall 205 area, conveniently located right off the 205. And you can check us out at pfgwm.com or at 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. And we'll be back next Saturday with Investing Simplified and hope to hear from you. Keep our numbers and give us a call next week. Thank you very much and have a great weekend. Price Financial Group, wealth.